Before we begin today's episode, we just want to thank all of you who have liked and subscribed to Drop of Inspiration. Our last episode broke the record for most downloads since the podcast began, and we're reaching more and more people every day. For those of you new to the podcast, please like, subscribe, and leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. Really great content is in the works, and we want to make sure you don't miss it. Now, let's start today's show with a Hawaiian legend.
When Mother Earth got pregnant and gave birth, she gave birth to a very deformed child, and that child was stillborn. It looked like a bulb. So she was very depressed. She buried the child into the ground, and she wept over it, and her tears sparked this bulb to start to sprout. And as the bulb grew, she got pregnant again, and she named the second child Haloa as well. So we'll call him Haloa too. Haloa noticed that around the sprouts of this bulb that was his brother, there were many keiki plants, many small plants, and he separated them all and planted them out. And those plants became the first kalo, or the first sustainable food for the Hawaiian people. So the Hawaiians truly believe that if you take care of the land and the plants of that land, that the land will take care of you.
Welcome to Drop of Inspiration. I'm your host, Deidreen Joyce. The voice we just heard belongs to Wade Lee. Wade was born and raised on the Big Island of Hawaii and can trace his roots far back to the beginnings of the Hawaiian Kingdom. Wade is a biologist, a conservationist, and obviously a really great storyteller. We started the episode with that particular story because it's foundational for our conversation today. The concept of a deeper connection to the earth that we have as human beings, and the notion of taking care of the land that in turn takes care of us. People like Wade, who make their homes in the islands of the Pacific, seem to have an inherent understanding of this concept. We had actually scheduled this interview earlier, but Mother Earth doesn't really respect deadlines. So when I first started working back in May, your name was at the top of the list for people to interview. Everybody was like, you gotta talk to Wade, he's got some great stories, it's a really great project that we're working on, but we've been delayed till now because of the recent eruption of Kilauea. Just give us any updates. How have things been over there, and where do they stand now?
Well, the eruption of Kilauea, you know, this past eruption that is now ceased, was the longest eruption that we have in recorded history. So this eruption actually started at what was known as the Pu'u'o event. And at Pu'u'o, it started erupting in 1983 and has not stopped. What happened in this particular event is we had another fissure open up in the Leilani Estates area, which is about 15 miles from Pu'u'o, but it was a residential area. And fissure 8 opened up, and the amount of activity and lava coming from fissure 8 was about 30 times the volume that had been going on for a number of years. So a lot of property was destroyed, but we did get about 180 additional acres added to the island. So the Big Island is the only place on Earth that is still growing in terms of land mass. In Hawaiian culture, Madam Pele is by far the queen of all gods, right? She is the ultimate creator. She's the ultimate destroyer. So whenever she's erupting, like the Hawaiians that lost their house under, if you ever saw the interviews with them, when the lava is coming, they actually welcome her into their home, to take their home. It's okay. It's not the end of the world. But for some cultures, that's like the end of all things. But to understand that through that destruction, life gets created is very special, and that's the way the Hawaiians look at it. It's different, you know.
Conversations with Wade seem to always go like this. You ask a simple question to get to know him better, and the next thing you know, you're engrossed in a conversation about life, the universe, and everything else. He has this practical reverence for nature and the earth, and understands the role that living things play in everyday life. This reverence is exactly why we're talking to him today. Wade is a managing member of Haloa Aina, a forestry and educational organization responsible for the Kona Sandalwood Reforestation Project. To grasp the full spectrum of this story, we're going to start way back in the 1700s with Captain James Cook. In 1769, the British government sent Captain Cook on a voyage to observe some astronomical events taking place in the Southern Hemisphere and to see if he could locate the long-fabled southern continent, now known as Antarctica. This led him to Tahiti, New Zealand, Australia, and the Polynesian Islands, all previously unknown to the Western world, and all possessing beauty and resources that foreign empires coveted. On Cook's third expedition, he landed in Hawaii, which he named the Sandwich Islands, after his friend, the Earl of Sandwich. Hawaiians greeted him and his crew with open arms and even celebration. But after the Europeans started greedily stripping the Hawaiians of food and supplies, their relationship started to go south, and Captain Cook was killed. Here's Wade talking about what Hawaii was like before Captain Cook arrived.
In the state of Hawaii, we have about 1.3 million people there. When Captain Cook landed, the population of Hawaiians at that time was 1.1 million. So it was by far the heaviest populated group of islands that he had come across through all of his voyages. He'd already been to Tahiti, Fiji, Tonga, had actually already been to New Zealand and Australia. But when he came into the Hawaiian Islands, over 1,000 canoes came out to greet his ship. And one of the things that we are very proud of as Hawaiians is that that 1.1 million was completely self-sustained. They were not starving, they were not anything, and it's because of their deep reverence to sustainability. Right now, with our 1.5 million people that we've got there, 99% of everything we consume is brought in. And the cost of living is through the roof. And that's because everything is shipped in. But when 1.1 million people were there, they didn't bring anything in. They lived off that land. And you got to understand that Kamehameha was 7'2" and weighed 400 pounds. He was the size of Shaq. This is not a small people. You know, they are impressive as far as human beings go. So in the Hawaiian culture, if I wanted to build a canoe, I would need a koa tree. To get that koa tree, I would have to go and ask permission from the ali'i, and then I would have to go up and ask permission from the forest itself or the land itself. And you would do a chant, and you would wait, and you would rest. And it might take 2 or 3 days, but the forest would tell you which tree the forest wanted you to take. It wouldn't be like you walk through the forest and you go, oh, this one will make me a great canoe, and you decide that's the tree. The link between the people, the land, and true sustainability is not something that is taken for granted in Hawaii. If you went up there without the permission of the ali'i and even took a bird or a tree, it was the death penalty. And it was a strict rules in Hawaii about what you can and cannot do. Because if you go out and you harm that ecosystem that is supporting this million people, you are putting everybody in jeopardy. So you have to maintain that sustainability at all times.
Unfortunately, during this period of rapid globalization, sustainability was the last thing on people's minds. Globalization is this inevitable snowball of processes that shape our world, and it can have both negative and positive consequences. However, in this case, the Native Hawaiians were stripped of the things they held most sacred.
The history of sandalwood in Hawaii is somewhat unique. It all started back in the 1700s, the late 1700s. And What had happened is there was a big fur trade going on between Canada, the northwestern United States, Alaska, and China. And the Chinese were coming over and buying the furs from the Native Americans and then shipping them back to China, and it was a huge profit. One of the stops that they were making was in Hawaii. And the Chinese realized the value of sandalwood at that time for the Muslims, Buddhist, and Hindu populations that are in Asia. Sandalwood is a very sacred tree. In those cultures, they carve idols. They do a lot of work with incense, which is known as the Agabadi market. It is the ritualistic burning of sandalwood for religious purposes. They burn their corpses with them. Mahatma Gandhi was burned with 4 tons of sandalwood for his corpse, because they believe that the sandalwood smoke actually takes it into nirvana, into heaven. Yeah, so there's a big demand for sandalwood in Asia. The Chinese realized that as these merchants were coming through Hawaii to resupply to get to Asia from America, they found sandalwood on the islands. So the Chinese name for Hawaii in translation actually means Sandalwood Mountain to this day. As the Chinese came through, they negotiated a price for sandalwood with King Kamehameha. And the sandalwood traded and started trading in 1797. So at that time, Kamehameha borrowed a bunch of money because he was building warships, basically British type warships, cannon, the whole thing, and he needed money for the Kingdom of Hawaii to defend itself against all of these new foreign powers that were coming around the Pacific. So he went into debt, and it's called the sandalwood debt. And he believed that he could replace that debt by putting a tax on the Hawaiian people. So he started a tax on the Hawaiian people where every Hawaiian had to deliver one picul, or 133 pounds of sandalwood, to the dock every year. The Hawaiians, never being taxed before, felt like they were being enslaved, because there was no benefit to them personally for doing that. It just meant that if you didn't do it, you were killed. So you did it, and you hired people to do it. And many of the people that were going out and doing it, they got sores on their backs and stuff, because you got to realize that they were walking barefoot. These logs were on their backs, and they were using lauhala straps, fiber straps, to hold those logs onto their backs. And we're talking 150-pound log walking miles. They became known as the lepo okoles, which means bad rear end, basically, with a bunch of sores on their back from carrying these logs. So the Hawaiians did not want to be the next generation to be enslaved by that. So they would kill all of the sandalwood that they could find, even if they weren't taking it to the dock, because they thought if it ran out, that would be the end of the taxation. What eventually happened, though, is the sandalwood never did run out. And in 1828, King Kamehameha IV, King Lunalilo, created 3 merchant ships and decided he was going to cut the Chinese merchants out and take the sandalwood to China on Kingdom of Hawaii ships. When he did that and got to China, the Chinese government would not allow him to unload those ships. So he brought the ships back and stacked the sandalwood on the sand at Kehi Lagoon, set the logs on fire in front of the Chinese merchants, and said there will be no more sandalwood shipped out of the state of Hawaii. And that was in 1828. Unfortunately, that didn't get rid of the debt, because the Chinese were owed this money. And after about 30 years of fighting that, the Hawaiians had to come up with money, and that's when the big land auctions started.
Hawaiians had for centuries respected their land so much that misusing it had been punishable by death. And now, after all that they had been through with the sandalwood trade, they were left in a position that in order to save their people, they had to abandon their land by selling it to outsiders. There was no shortage of foreign buyers ready to capitalize on such a unique ecosystem. Plantation owners, merchants, entrepreneurs, And even wealthy missionaries came in and bought up hundreds of thousands of acres of land.
So the Kingdom of Hawaii started auctioning off land. And one of the pieces of land was sold to the Greenwell family. And the Greenwells ended up with about 400,000 acres on the Big Island. The 3,000 acres that Haloa Aina sits on now was part of that auction. So when you're looking at the Kingdom of Hawaii and Iolani Palace and all of the wonderful things that they did, all of that was funded by sandalwood. So in some ways, it's recognized in history as a very beneficial thing to the kingdom, but in other ways, to the local person, it was the first tax. It enslaved the Hawaiian people and gave the kingdom a bad name. So there's still that underlying essence, because obviously that kind of a practice where you just send everybody out, all of the cultural things that we were just talking about, how to take care of the land and stuff, just went out the window. So it was a tragic time in Hawaiian history from a cultural perspective. But needing those warships and needing to get financially secure in the middle of the Pacific with a million people is not an easy task. It's really complicated. You have the British, you have the Americans, you had the Russians, you had the Chinese, you had the Dutch, who all still now have colonized all of the islands in the Pacific at one time. The French are in Polynesia. The Tongan Islands are still controlled by the Dutch. You know, so the British still control Fiji. You know, America now controls the Hawaiian Islands. So King Kamehameha was actually trying to defend that. And in his lifetime, he accomplished that. But it did come at a price. And it was a hard price to pay. This land, until the Great Mahele in 1853, when the Kingdom of Hawaii took all of the land away from the individual ali'i, was owned by the Kamamalu family. And we have direct lineage from the Kamamalu family. And my great-grandmother was Mary Kawehewehe Oke Ali'i o Kalani Kamamalu. And she was the last pure Hawaiian in my lineage. She married a man called Lee Tai Hung. And that's where I get my last name. That's why my last name is Lee. So Lee Tai Hung was one of those Chinese merchants that I was talking about earlier. The Chinese were very big at the time in Hawaii in terms of how much money they had. And they still control a good part of the Hawaii business, are the Chinese people that came to Hawaii around the turn of the 19th century.
Wade is the descendant of the Hawaiian royals who had to auction the land after the sandalwood trade, and the descendant of one of the Chinese merchants. This means that he has a personal heritage distinctly intertwined with sandalwood history, and it makes him a perfect candidate to restore the balance his ancestors struggled with all those centuries ago.
My family's history, like, you know, we talked a little bit about before, this land, until the Great Mahele in 1853, when the Kingdom of Hawaii took all of the land away from the individual ali'i, was owned by the Kamamalu family. And we have direct lineage from the Kamamalu family. And that was part of the Keaho Ahupua'a that was purchased by the Greenwell family. So when our family lost that land, we were given smaller pieces by the kingdom. So this 400,000 acres that was Keaho Ahupua'a, our family ended up with about 10 acres. And the rest of the land was sold to the Greenwells, who was a missionary family. And our family has been associated with that land and been on that land as workers, as employees throughout time, and we're still there. So I have pictures, if you come up to the cabin, of my grandfather there in the 50s and my father being there in the 60s and 70s. That land is, in particular, is very close and dear to our family.
As a biologist and storyteller with Native Hawaiian heritage, Wade knew what this land had once been, and it pained him to see what had happened to it during the last few centuries. When Wade got word that one of the current owners was going to sell, he acted fast.
Filipinos say kumpao. Hawaiians say hui. Yeah, so we hui'd all our money together and got a down payment together to buy the land back and to see what we could do in terms of trying to get that land reforested so that it would be sustainable for the rest of time. So that land we bought was millions of dollars. And I was a high school teacher. So by getting all of the family members together, at our last family reunion, we had 3,000 people there. It was held at Blaisdell. You know, so it's a huge family. So we own 3,000 acres there, but we manage 40,000 acres there now. Under the same management principles that we use at Aloha Aina, we manage 40,000 acres around us in the same way. So a lot of that aupua is starting to get back that kind of recognition. Yeah? The landowners that we work with are the state, Kamehameha Schools, as well as the federal government now. We're working with the Department of Defense as well.
Not only were they able to buy back 3,000 acres of Kamemalu land, but they were able to negotiate managing the surrounding 40,000 acres with state and federal agencies, including the Department of Defense. A combination of passion, research, and know-how have helped Wade and his team show Hawaii and the world their vision of restoring the ecological integrity of the area.
Biologically, this sandalwood tree, because of its hemiparasitic nature, it needs a host. When you start a sandalwood tree from a seed, the first year of its life, it actually has root hairs. And it's the root hairs is where a tree or any plant will absorb water and nutrients from the soil. Mm-hmm. Within 1 year of this plant's life, all of the root hairs fall off. And at that time, it has to have attached its roots to another plant. And that plant then becomes the sole source of nutrients for the sandalwood tree. So if you plant sandalwood in like you would plant corn or macadamia nuts or sugarcane, the way it's been done for about 100 years and continually failed. And I think that's what led to it being such a rarity, is because people had a hard time figuring out how to grow this tree. When you plant it out in the field, you have to plant it with a host. So in our nurseries, we plant the sandalwood tree right at the start, as soon as it sprouts, with a host. Now that host is going to get sacrificed. Within a year, that tree is dead. And we use koa, and we use momani, and we use nio. And
those are all native plants, yeah.
All native plants. Mm-hmm. We don't do anything but native plants. And all of the ones that we use in this seeding process are nitrogen fixtures. They're legumes. They're in the acacia family. So once we take that plant, we grow it for about 6 months. It'll get about 8 inches in height, and the host plant will be about the same. We take them out into the field, and we plant them into the ground. And this is something that a lot of volunteers have helped us with. But over the last 9 years, we have done this to over 500,000 trees. So we plant them, and then around them, you have to plant other trees. But instead of planting other trees, a lot of times what we'll do is promote the growth that is already there. So we have this process where we will take banana peels, which are full of gibberellins, which are growth hormones for plants, and we soak them in water, and then we will water the area around the plant where we got, and the seed bank within the soil gets germinated, and you get natural sprouting. So we don't grow the way a normal farm would grow. We are very much letting nature dictate where those trees come up. If nothing comes up, then we help it by planting.
Wade saying they don't do things like other farms is an understatement. Their property is less like a farm and more like a giant diorama of a very ambitious environmental experiment. On the side of a mountain wilderness, Wade and a group of passionate individuals treat every single living thing in the area as if it were their own child. I cannot emphasize enough how passionate these people are about this beautiful place. Haloa Aina's biologist, Ton Spiegitz, gave us a tour of the grounds. Ton is a lot like Wade. He's incredibly intelligent, but also super down to earth, and he's very passionate about the flora and fauna under his stewardship. We have over 5 hours of audio of Ton getting into the details of sandalwood, all the way down to a molecular level. His attention to detail is astounding. In fact, when he was driving us to the top of the property, he suddenly slammed on the brakes, got out, and ran over to an unsuspecting bush, pulling something off of it and running back. When he got back in the truck, he looked like a kid on Christmas morning. He explained that a virus had been brought to the island from South America and it was killing one of the native bushes. He then showed us a handful of seeds and pointed to the bush that they came from. It looked like a normal bush, and that was the point. Around it were several bushes of the same species, all of them dead from the virus. But for some reason, this one was fine. Maybe this one had developed some kind of resistance, and Ton was going to plant and care for as many of these bushes as possible, to see if he could create a population that was resistant to the virus. His level of enthusiasm left no doubt in our minds that this land was in good hands. Everyone working at the Sandalwood Reforestation Project reminds me of the second Haloa in a story Wade shared at the beginning of the episode. They mindfully support the environment, like the living, breathing thing that it is. The more we talked to Wade, Ton, and the rest of the team, the more that the land became an important character in the overall story, with its own personality, struggles, and strengths. Putting your heart and soul into a project of this magnitude is not easy, nor is it cheap. There were still bills to pay to keep the operation going. So they reached out to the only buyer they knew of, the same one that started the Hawaiian sandalwood trade all those centuries ago. But it wasn't quite the vision they had for the future of Santalum paniculatum.
One of the things that I wanted to make very clear too is when we started, we weren't doing oil. Because the sandalwood trade was going the way it was, back in the Kingdom of Hawaii, we were kind of, that was our first shot. You know, I thought, well, maybe we ought to just see if the Chinese are still interested in the sandalwood and see what they can give us so that we can build a nursery and do all these wonderful things. And we sold sandalwood to China and to India for about 2 years. What really didn't settle right with us was the fact that they were burning it. In Hawaiian culture, it was used for skin fungus. The Hawaiians call it kane, and nowadays I guess it's more referred to as hauli rot on your skin. But when you spend a lot of time in the ocean and in the sun, your skin gets very warm, and then you get fungus and ringworm and some other things. The sandalwood was used by the Hawaiians as a medicine. It used to help with the hair lice. It used to help with the fungus on skin fungus. Jock foot, as they call it now, you know, toenail fungus. It's great on those kinds of things. And the Hawaiians used it for that. So when we started looking at better ways to maintain the cultural side of it, we were looking for a partner that would understand what we were trying to do and would not, I wouldn't have to worry about, where am I going to sell this? What am I going to do? I had been to a lot of trade shows. I was going, you know, this is not what I did this for.
There are 15 different species of sandalwood that grow around the globe with varying uses and biological makeups. As Haloa Aina looked to the future, they needed a partner that not only respected the science of what they were doing, but also respected the tumultuous history of this specific species. It's important to look critically at the past and take those lessons to build something better. Wade's intentions are deeply shaped by his Hawaiian heritage. His mission and vision are very much directed toward a more sustainable future. For that to happen, he needed to truly return to the days when the land depended on the people and the people depended on the land. Eventually, a buyer who had the same vision came calling, literally.
Well, the first time I met Gary Young, he called me up, actually called me and my brother, Jeff Lee, who was also my partner at the time, from the airport when he had arrived in Kailua-Kona. And he wanted to come up and see what was going on with in terms of Hawaiian, native Hawaiian sandalwood that he'd heard something about. And neither one of us knew who Gary Young was. I didn't even know who Young Living was. At the time, we were selling wood back into Asia, just like our ancestors had done before. And he called up and he said, well, you know, he needed a ride from the airport and this and that. And I was 3 hours away. So I told him, there's no possible way, dude. I'm not going to come pick you up, man. I'm all good. So we hung up the phone, and about an hour later, he said, well, you know, I just booked a room at the Hilton. Can you come pick me up tomorrow morning? And I said, this guy is, you know, he's kind of persistent. I told him, yeah, all right, I'll come and grab you. So on the way to work the next morning, I stopped by and we jumped in the car and went up to the property and we started walking around. And it was probably within the first hour that Gary started talking about essential oil and what we could be doing and this and that. And we were looking at our stills and he had all of these comments and said, I said, well, you know a lot about sandalwood oil. He goes, yeah, I own Young Living. And I said, great, what's that? So by the end of the day, he called Mary, and Mary brought over the two boys, and we have a cabin up there. And he ended up staying in the cabin for the rest of the week. No cell phone, no Wi-Fi, and I had a 30-06 that I keep inside because the wild game, the pigs and the sheep, eat the baby sandalwood trees, you know? So he says, what's that 30-06 for? I didn't know he was a hunter, you know, and he goes, I said, well, we got wild sheep and wild pigs and stuff. He says, you mind if I take that gun and take my boys hunting? I said, well, go ahead. You know? But that's kind of the way it started. So then he said, I need you to come to Utah, and I'll pay for your trip. And I was like, I don't want to go to Utah. He says, no, you got to come and see our operation. And because he was so good with just the way he was, he was inspiring. His mind would get so full of ideas, and it would just flow. And I know that, you know, in the real world, that can be a very difficult place to be. But in our situation, it was kind of exactly what we were looking for. We were looking for some way to regain the human uses in a manner that would help human beings instead of, at the time, we were selling into the Agha body market and it was being burnt as incense. And we actually flew 2 tons of wood to Dubai to burn a monk there. And we had flown a ton to New Jersey. And they were putting it in the bellies of 747s, and we were selling about $8 million a year in sandalwood to Asia. And, you know, after speaking with Gary, we decided to do an explore together some of the aspects of actually turning this into oil. So we took the oil, had some samples run up at California State University. We had worked with some guys that were operating stills that came from South Africa, and we shipped some wood out. Gary took some over to the Idaho plant and cooked it underground because we wanted to see if there was going to be any variability. So we wanted it processed in different places and different things. Come to find out, it's a very high quality oil, one of the highest in the world. You know, and it's very special in some of the ways that its components are blended together. It's one of the greatest bases for blends because of the way that it serves as a palette, if you will, for other oils. Sandalwood oil in itself should probably never be used neat, and it should probably always be blended with something because it is a very, very potent oil. So all of these things, you know, we finally got to understand. We got the research together. Gary came back. I've got several autographed pictures of him. And we worked together very closely in terms of trying to figure out how we make everything work.
Both Wade and Gary believed that the most important thing in this undertaking was to restore the forest to its original state. While Haloa Aina had refined their approaches to cultural values and scientific practices, they needed an economic boost to push them forward. Selling oil extracted from the Royal Hawaiian sandalwood trees would pay tribute to the historical uses of the plant, as well as allow continued research on the biological makeup of the species. To continue their shared vision of sustainable reforestation, they agreed to continue to only harvest sandalwood trees at the end of their life cycle, leaving the younger trees to mature and grow undisturbed. Through their research, they found that the best sandalwood oil came from these dying trees. It was a perfect fit.
In terms of our vision for sustainability, know, when you're looking at growing a crop specifically to earn money, to support your mortgage payment, your house payments, your employees, and all of that is very important. You can't force an ecosystem to provide what you need. What we try to do is take a look at what the ecosystem is providing and then see what we can accomplish using those tools. So at Haloa Aina, we only harvest the dead and the dying trees. And the reason we do that, one, obviously, is for sustainability, because we can let the trees grow and they seed and they produce more seeds and they drop. But from the standpoint of the oil, the dying and the dead trees have a much better quality oil. So if you're looking at a plantation-grown 20-year-old tree, its chemical composition is very different from a tree that has gone through its life cycle in totality. Because a sandalwood tree in all of the genus, all of the Santalum genus, has a very slow death period. And that death period could take 20 years. So it starts to fade. And as it starts to fade, it gets attacked by microorganisms. And as it gets attacked by the microorganisms, in its defense, it deposits minerals into the heartwood, forms the oil. And if you look at a cut of a sandalwood tree and where the inclusions are coming in, where the attack is coming in, you'll see dark rings around it. That's actually sandalwood oil that the tree made to protect itself from that attacker. So what you want to do is you want to have that tree produce as much oil in the highest quality to protect itself. Inevitably, that tree is going to die. The oldest trees we've been able to find on our property are 86 years old. So a sandalwood tree is not a long-lived tree. The last 30 years of its life has been spent defending itself. Its hosts are gone. It's having a rough time. And as it goes through that process, that's when that good quality oil is produced. And then we can use that to help make our lives better. So all of the funds that we generate economically from this go back into the forest. Nobody's ever taken a draw from Haloa Aina. No one ever did. I live in a house that was built in 1964 in a plantation town called Honoka'a. And you're welcome to come visit anytime you want.
I'll take you up on that sometime.
We do take care of the land. And if you go to Haloa Aina, if you ever have the opportunity to come there, I think you'd be very surprised at, as you come up the road, as what's happening with the land, and all of a sudden you go through our gate and it's a different world. The vibe is different. The look is different. We've got a great education center up there now. It's a fantastic place to be. It truly is.
At the beginning of the episode, we learned of the legend of two brothers named Haloa. One represented the land, while the other represented humanity, and they cared for each other like families do. Inspired by this simple folktale, Wade, backed by a team of passionate individuals and a distribution partner who respected his vision, has gone above and beyond to repair and restore the balance to this mountain ecosystem and its inhabitants.
Every Hawaiian, as part of that ahupua'a, would get designated what was known as a kuleana. And kuleana is the responsibility of taking care of a specific piece of your family's land. Kuleana is also the same term that is used in Hawaiian for the word respect. So when you say respect the land, it's kind of a redundancy, because it is your kuleana. It is your responsibility to respect that land. So we got together, we bought this land, and it is a pasture that has been abused for about 200 years. And looking at the land, we had a strat meeting and we were trying to figure out what we were going to use for the name of our company. Haloa literally means long breath of the land or long spirit of the land, because ha, in the first syllable of the word, is your spirit or your soul. And it refers to the actual breath that you take in and then release. Loa is long. So Aina is land. So the long breath of the land. But Haloa goes back even deeper into the cultural aspects from the Kumulipu, which is the legends that were taught to people about how to live your life and how to get along with nature, if you will. So the story of Haloa in the Kumulipu refers to Mother Earth and Father Sky getting together to create the first human being, the first Hawaiian, if you will. When Mother Earth got pregnant and gave birth, she gave birth to a very deformed child, and that child was stillborn. It looked like a bulb. So she was very depressed. She buried the child into the ground, and she wept over it. And her tears sparked this bulb to start to sprout. And as the bulb grew, she got pregnant again, and she named the second child Haloa as well. So we'll call him Haloa too. Haloa noticed that around the sprouts of this bulb that was his brother, there were many keiki plants, many small plants, and he separated them all and planted them out. And those plants became the first kalo, or the first sustainable food for the Hawaiian people. So the Hawaiians truly believe that if you take care of the land and the plants of that land, that the land will take care of you. So that's also a reason that we use Haloa Aina as our name. It's because our whole mission is based upon education and taking care of the land so that the land will take care of the people of Hawaii for all eternity in a sustainable manner.
According to Wade and other environmentalists I've talked to, there are always three basic pillars to sustainability: education, culture, and economics. While writing this episode, I realized that the true story here was about balance. Giving as much as you take, looking to the past for the building blocks of the future, and finding people who are willing to revel in the work with you. Even Santalum paniculatum, as impressive as it is as a species, needs a host plant to lean on. There's no balance that can be achieved alone, and carrying out big dreams like this only works if you're moving forward together. To close out today's episode, here's Wade talking about this part of the legacy Gary Young left behind.
Gary Young saw what we were doing in a matter of minutes. He understood. So he stepped in, and it gave us the cash flow that we needed to pay the bills and to do the reforestation. It was a blessed day. It really took a lot of pressure off and allows us to do other kinds of things. But over the last year, we've missed him. And I think the world has lost a very special human being. And I know that there are some people out there that probably think he was a little eccentric. But I tell you, you know, from someone who spent a good deal of time with him in a very private place, that man was golden. His heart was in the right place. He was always thinking about others. And I think what the legacy that he's left will go on forever, I'm hoping. And he will always be with us, no matter what happens, you know. I just hope that Young Living can carry on some of the dreams that he had, because there are some hefty dreams and some big ideas. But yeah, I'm really gonna miss him. When I got the news, it came directly from the family, and it took a week before I could even talk about it, because it's tough. It's really tough, and I hope somebody feels that way when I go.